So this is the this is a continuation of the interview on ILS with Aaron Ide, and it's now August 1st, 1983, and we're in the History of Science seminar room. So you're continuing to talk about your chairmanship, or were you...
All right, I'll continue with that. I believe I was dealing with the age of dissent and student attitudes in ILS, particularly during the last years of the 1960s, when there was a good deal of student dissent anyhow. ILS, from the beginning, tended to attract a disproportionate number of rather liberal, even radical-minded students. And in the early years, this seemed to add some attractive color to the program. I don't want to give the impression that they were all radicals. For example, one of our students in the mid-50s was William Steiger of Oshkosh, whose father was later a regent at the university. Bill Steiger was very politically motivated and was one of the conservative students who was instrumental in creating the opposition to the Cardinal. I forget the name of the paper. I believe it's still being published. But at any
rate... Are you talking about the Badger Herald?
The Herald, yes.
Ah.
That's right, yes. Well, Bill was very... active in conservative political activities, using ILS somewhat as a base. So we had a spectrum of students of all political philosophies, quite a few of them fairly active on one side or another. At any rate, in the mid-60s, the radical movement at Berkeley and other places also became apparent at the Wisconsin campus. I think a lot of us on the faculty were rather complacent and had the idea that it couldn't happen here, that Wisconsin had always listened to students and given them a hearing, that there was a faculty representative of all shades of opinion, and that students respected this. It was somewhat of a surprise to some of us, like Dave Fellman and Ed Young and others, to find out how much we were out of touch with the thinking of the radical element. The Dow riot proved to be an eye-opener, I think, and gradually the faculty began to realize what they were facing, but I think the faculty at Wisconsin was slow to realize that this trouble at Berkeley was apt to turn up at Wisconsin at the same level of intensity. At any rate, the ILS student body was ready-made to be a leader in the dissent movement. I remember one morning when I went into my lecture room, where most of the students were assembled for my physical universe lecture, I saw Odell Taliaferro, my demonstrator, talking to a very young person at the front of the room. And Tally said, well, you'll have to talk to Ide and find out what he is willing to let you do. At any rate, this chap came to me and said that he requested an opportunity to speak to the students on relevance in academic affairs. I recognized that this was trouble, but I told him that I would give him 5 minutes to state his case. When the bell rang, I moved back several rows and sat down among a few of the students. After telling the students that this young man wished to make a statement, he started in by condemning courses like this as having no relevance to things that were important these days, that their professors were teaching them reactionary points of view, giving them no opportunity for input into course materials. His case actually was rather poorly presented, and I found out later that he was a boy from Brooklyn who was moving across the country attempting to create student disturbances. He was probably...
So he wasn't a member of your class?
Oh, no, he was not a member of the class. He was an outsider.
Mm.
But outsiders were not unwelcome in ILS courses. We frequently had people who sat in and listened. Former students sometimes came back and listened. Students brought friends who were visiting. Mm. So outsiders were never unwelcome in ILS courses, and I didn't think very much about this when the request to address the class came up. At any rate, he rambled very badly about the United States as an empire which was treading on underdeveloped countries, that it was dominated by a conservative class, a very rambling presentation. And all of a sudden, the students, bless them, started chanting, "We want Eid." And his message was crushed through the student chant, which picked up intensity.
Mm-hmm.
And finally he said, "I am requesting the students in this class to join me in leaving trivialities of this sort and going out to start the revolution." And he started to walk up the stairs to the back of the room, apparently expecting students to follow him. He had a few henchmen planted at the back of the room, and of course they followed him out, but the rest of the students retained their places. And I used the rest of that period not to discuss science, but to discuss the problems that had been raised by this intrusion.
Mm. You'd been thinking a lot about them yourself already,
I had been thinking about them myself, and I sought to get student discussion where discontent might be brought out and might be addressed with counter-arguments. And we spent that whole hour discussing the implications of what had started.
Did the students talk about it also?
Yes. And yes, they did.
Well, can you remember?
And there were some who were impressed by the position of the intruder and condemned U.S. imperialism and so on in our discussion. I sought to address this charge, and other students sought to address it, but it was a very healthy incident.
So they weren't talking about whether studying the history of science was relevant, which is the more interesting.
No, that point didn't come up. The major discussion centered around whether the U.S. Was an imperialist nation, and whether the public had any opportunity to have its voice heard in the U.S. with essentially all parts of the spectrum represented in the discussion. There were a great many students who felt that this intrusion was uncalled for, that the U.S. probably was had as much freedom for the individual as any country in the world. There were others who took a very extreme position that the U.S. was a dirty imperialist pig. And I thought that we had a very fruitful discussion, which caused many of the students to really start thinking about what this all was all about, and whether radical positions were able to be heard and to have a healthy impact if the positions of the radical spokesman were sound.
What year was this, do you remember?
I don't remember the year exactly. It was the first year that I lectured in the new chemistry building, so it must have been fall of 67 or 68. I think it was fall of 68.
You can't place it by the Dow demonstration, whether it was before or after
it was
that.
Several years after the Dow
demonstration.
Well,
that was 67.
It was the Dow 67? Mm. Well, then this was 68.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But it created a great deal of interest on the part of the students. For one thing, they were amazed at the way I announced that this chap would have a few minutes to present his position, and I went and sat down several rows from the front and did not interfere with what he was saying until the students became restless and started chanting, "We want iron." So here was, this was one case which hit very close to home and very unexpectedly, but I felt that we came out of it quite well, and provided an opportunity for students to have their views aired.
Did it at any time, was there a discussion of the relevance of the teaching material in ILS?
Yes, there was. And in fact, in the next several years, there was a great deal of attack on the content of ILS courses.
Was it in terms of ILS was not as good as other courses, or that it was a good course to take but should be different from what it was?
I think that down deep in their minds, students had the attitude that it was as good a program as was available in the university, but by golly, they weren't going to admit that anything was good.
But there wasn't that they wanted to try and change the subject matter.
Oh, yes,
matter.
Yes.
Did you get an idea?
There was a handful that was very adamant that the course content was not relevant to modern day problems, and that ILS had never been changed from day one. This was, of course, lack of information.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the one thing that bothered me a whole lot about the dissent movement was that students assumed whatever they wished, whatever fit their argument, they assumed. And a lot of very false history of the university mm-hmm. was mouthed during this period. So one of them was the charge that ILS had been created in 1948 and never changed. Well, this is just not...
But it had changed,
hadn't it? Oh, yes, it had changed very substantially. My own course changed very drastically over the years, and I continued making changes almost to the point of my retirement. Other professors changed, and of course there were changes of professors teaching particular courses. Mm-hmm. The basic format of ILS, I always felt, was very sound. But different professors handled a particular course in a different manner.
Mm-hmm.
So there were changes in that respect, particularly as faculty changes were made. One of the problems that students have in criticizing a university is that they are transients who are around for only 4 years. And as a result, they do not see programs evolve in the same way that faculties see them. faculties are around, many of them for many years. Students are around for four.
Might and consider giving a couple of lectures on the history of the university, I suppose. That'd be interesting.
Well, there's a limit to how much one can indoctrinate.
One
sometimes thinks that we ought to have a course at the beginning of the freshman year which tells students what the university is, what the opportunities are, what its philosophy is. Students find those introductory courses something to be avoided.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't. I would agree with them, but I should think a non-indoctrinating history of what
I think that faculty ought to philosophize a bit more than they do about the subject, about the university, mm-hmm. about the world in general. I have sometimes felt that I did my best teaching on a one-to-one basis when a student came into my office and there were no straight and narrow paths that the discussion must follow. And I sometimes did some of this in the classroom. I had a tendency to get off the subject mm-hmm. in the classroom. And I used to run discussion sections through most of my teaching career. And these discussion sections were a fascinating thing because you had an opportunity to teach on a more intimate basis with the student. And you could be led off the path without harm, without wasting your time.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that even departing from the subject matter in favor of philosophical or historical other points of view were perhaps one's best teaching.
And did you feel that the response of the students, did their response show that they agreed, or did they get restless?
I had many comments, particularly in later years. After students were through with my courses, they would sometimes drop around to say hello,
mm-hmm.
sit down and visit for a while. And they would remark that that these asides were brought up things which they never forgot. Generally, about the time I was about to give my first hour exam, talked to the students for 5 minutes on the importance of facing examinations realistically, that one didn't have to get an A in PU to be a success in life, but hopefully that they would develop some appreciation of the nature of science that would stand them in good stead in the future. And a fair number of students used to comment to me that this was one of the best things I ever did because they took a more level-headed attitude toward examinations and grades and so on.
It sounds good to me.
Well, I was always a sort of a tough grader, and I felt that only very outstanding students deserved A's. I was probably a soft touch for a B, but A's had to be earned, and very definitely represented a lot of understanding in the subject matter. But students seemed to appreciate little things like this, which caused them to take a broader view of life in general. And sometimes my remarks were brought back to me as something that had a rather profound impact.
Oh, that's nice. When was it that you started going into the history of science?
I am not sure. I've tried to ponder that. for many years.
Oh.
And I think that I had a latent interest in history even in high school.
I was thinking of more specifically when you started teaching it.
I see. I started teaching history of chemistry in 1946, shortly after the war ended.
So that was in, and ILS was beginning in
1948? Met students in the fall of 48. So I was into history of chemistry as a formal course 2 years before I started ILS.
The reason for the question was that you must have had to do a great deal of preparing for this course. The reading that you had to do must have been quite different from what you had done up to then.
It was very different and very challenging. I found it one of the most exciting periods in my life.
Hmm.
Particularly since I had to face the teaching of some astronomical material.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I had a chemistry major in my undergraduate days and a graduate degree in chemistry, which involved quite a bit of chemistry and some physics, but I had never had any astronomy. When ILS was created, the physical science course was to deal with material from astronomy, physics, and chemistry.
Mm-hmm. And to deal with it historically?
Well, not necessarily. The charge was to deal with it in meaningful segments, using whatever approach one wished. Now, I wished to use a historical approach, so my material in physical universe was essentially a series of case histories of how ideas developed and what impact the changing ideas had. I sought to get students to see that science was not a fixed body of knowledge, but an ever-changing body of knowledge as better experiments and better insights led to new ways of thinking about scientific materials. Now, the course, as it was set up by the committee that created ILS, called for material from astronomy, physics, and chemistry. I felt that I did my best teaching in astronomy, a field in which I knew virtually nothing, but it was a fascinating challenge. I decided very early after being invited to teach physical universe that I would treat astronomy as a first unit and treat it from the standpoint of why natural philosophers changed their point of view from an Earth-centered universe to a Sun-centered universe. This taking place in the 16th and 17th centuries. And in order to do this, I felt it would be useful for students to actually go out at night and learn to identify constellations, stars, and planets. And in the early years, my assistants and I used to meet the students after dark on Observatory Hill and look around at the constellations and planets in the evening sky in September.
Is this 200 students doing this?
Well, we did it in sections. I taught one or two sections and I had several teaching assistants. I used to take the teaching assistants out on the hill before registration and teach them what I wanted them to do with their classes. And then each section went as a separate unit. Sometimes there were two or three sections up there at the same time, but there was enough room that we could avoid interfering with one another.
Was this, were you already thoroughly familiar with the planets? They're not that easy to find.
I made myself familiar with it during the previous year. In fact, when Pooley asked me to teach this course, I felt somewhat on unsound ground as far as astronomy was concerned. So I went up and talked to Professor Stebbins, who was director of the observatory at that time. And we had a very interesting talk, in the course of which he said to me, I had said to him, I had reservations about my ability to handle the astronomy in the course. And he said to me, well, you have a PhD in chemistry, don't you? Yes. So therefore, you must know some chemistry. I understand that chemists also study some physics, don't they? Yes. So you ought to be able to handle the elementary physics that would be in.
This is take five.
Stebbins said to me that I should be able to handle the physics because chemists always knew some physics. And then he looked me in the eye and said, now, Ide, if you can't learn enough astronomy to handle the elementary aspects of astronomy for a course like this, you should never have been given a PhD in science. Well, I had Stebbins' blessing at the beginning, which was what I needed. And I also found Charles Hoffer of the astronomy department to be very helpful and supportive. So I ended up doing a lot of stargazing during those months that I was preparing for this course.
With them or by yourself?
No, by myself. Uh-huh. I got star guides and things of that sort and went about this systematically. My wife warned the people in the neighborhood that they shouldn't be disturbed if there was a man prowling around backyards in the dark of the night. And I made myself completely familiar with the constellations and the position of the planets and their movement.
Huh.
And I felt that by the time I began teaching the course that I had a quite solid background of elementary sky lore.
You must have been pretty, it must have been exciting to do that.
It was a fascinating summer. And I remember that I took my family on a 3,000-mile auto tour of the West. And the West was a delightful place to watch the sky because there was no competition from city lights.
Mm.
So I was teaching sky lore to my family at the same time that I was preparing myself. So when classes started, we took the students out a couple of times for some information about what to look for in the sky and how to find things. We used the pole star as the very first thing that they learned to identify. And once they had the pole star, they could pick up the Big Bear.
This new to them?
It was new to them, yes.
Really?
No high schools in that day taught any astronomy.
But people belonged to scouts or went to camp?
Well, a few of the students had a little scouting background in astronomy. But the great majority, it was entirely new to the students. And I think that electing to tackle some astronomy in the beginning of the course was good because there was a very bad mix of student background in the ILS science courses. There were students in the class who had had 4 years of high school science.
Mm.
There were students in the class who had had zero units of science when they entered the university.
That comes out in the newsletter that they published. I saw some comments about that.
Math background was equally heterogeneous. Some had some math into calculus. Some had maybe a course in elementary algebra, and that was it.
And you decided not to exempt the ones who were prepared?
No, I decided to work with whatever I got and to utilize rather elementary math when it was necessary to show mathematical relationships, but to have special help sections for students who had very little background and needed some help.
Did you teach those? Or?
I usually taught those myself. I would invite anyone who felt the need to come for an evening or two, and we would go through the necessary math. So we managed fairly well. I don't think that anybody failed the course because of lack of mathematics and science background. And of course, approaching the subject of astronomy from the standpoint of what do we see when we look at the heavens, and follow this with how do we interpret what we see. Well, the early interpretation followed Ptolemy and placed the Earth as a stationary body in the center with sun, moon, and planets and the stars moving around it. Well, as you go over the centuries, by the 1400s, when the age of the great navigations was beginning to occur, the Ptolemaic system no longer put planets where they were calculated to be. That is, the
yes,
planets were somewhere else. Not far, but they were not in the exact position that the Ptolemaic system predicted.
Hold on a moment. Mm-hmm. All right. Carry on.
Well,
actually, I'm going to stop you in a little. So.
These students quickly entered into the spirit of the thing and began to recognize that scientific theories are not necessarily facts, and that they are subject to change as new evidence comes into the picture. Do we want to continue this, or should we move on to something?
I wonder what happened. I know that, as I said, that there was discontent of the students with science because of those who'd had already, you say, 4 years of science in high school. How did you handle them, and how did they take this?
Well, in the early years, I tried to handle it by giving them more advanced work to do on their own. Some of them, of course, had no interest in doing extra work, but some of the students were quite eager to tackle additional reading or additional exercise.
You mean additional reading, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then in the 1960s, after the honors program started, we generally separated off the people with strong scientific backgrounds into an honors section. Which I myself taught for a number of years, and then had it taught by one of the key teaching assistants who was well experienced. So when the honors program came into being, well, we could handle those students with a lot of science much more effectively than we did in the early years. In the early years, it was largely voluntary extra work on their part.
Mm-hmm.
Then later, they were incorporated into an honors section.
When I asked you about your preparation for this course, did you read widely in books that were generally histories of science?
I read very extensively in history of science. Yes.
Were there any particularly good ones that you remember?
Singer's Short History of Science was very useful. And I picked up several histories of astronomy and histories of physics. I learned in this experience that students many times understand difficult material best if it appears before them in the same way that this appeared before important scientists. For example, if a student sees a body of facts develop in the way that scientific leaders who uncovered those facts see them develop, the student has a better understanding of them.
Well, you said that was the way you taught chemistry, wasn't it?
Right, yes. And so many college science teachers, and I think this goes into high school too, teach science from the present state of the art, mm-hmm. with no consideration of where the ideas came from. In PU, which is what the students called this course, I gave them a quite solid dose of Dalton's atomic theory, because this is the first view of atoms that had a profound impact in chemistry. And I rehearsed with them the things that Dalton did, which led him to recognize that perhaps chemical combination could best be understood from the standpoint of unit weights of material combining with unit weights of other elements. Mm. And this naturally led to the concept that there must be finite weights of oxygen or carbon, and that those finite weights are represent atoms. Then later on, when we get toward the end of the 19th century, you have such things as spectroscopy, which obviously comes from disturbed atoms. You have radioactivity, which represents atoms changing into new elements. And this is completely opposite Dalton's concept that an atom is permanent forever.
Yes. There again, we're getting into something that's written, but that is interesting that you to give an example of it. There wasn't any lab work, was there?
There was no lab work in this course. There was lab work in the succeeding ILS science courses, but not in mine.
Oh, I see. Yours was the very first.
So I gave a fairly significant amount of exercise work and did many demonstrations in the lecture. Mm-hmm. The lecture was rarely without demonstrations of some sort.
You went down to Chicago one year. Did you do that every year?
Did you hear about the Chicago trips?
No, I read
trips?
It in the...
In the Pioneer?
The Pioneer, yes.
Yes. During the very first year, as student interest in astronomy was developing, the idea hit me that maybe the students would benefit by going to the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and seeing a planetarium show. Mm-hmm. So I arranged with the planetarium to receive the class. We chartered three buses and drove down to Chicago, leaving the campus very early one Saturday morning. And getting there in time for a planetarium show at 11 a.m., where the planetarium director was in a position to show retrograde motion of planets and some of the things that we had been talking about. Mm-hmm. So that was quite effective, and of course the Field Museum is just across the street, so the students had a chance to look at many of the exhibits on anthropology and have that benefit just at the time that they were studying early man in the social science course. Now we tried on the very first trip to make a stop at Yerkes Observatory and see the big 40-inch telescope, 40-inch lens. At Yerkes, we got there quite late, but we had a chance to see the telescope and learn how it was used and so on before getting back to Madison quite late that night. We dropped the Yerkes stop in subsequent years. We did this for a number of years, and it was one of the highlights of the semester. The earth science people also followed up with field trips. They went to Devil's Lake, mm-hmm. one weekend during the course and saw various rock formations and learned it firsthand.
Did the students have to pay for this?
This was very nominal. The cost of the buses had to be covered by the students themselves, but mm-hmm. it was a matter of only a few dollars, mm-hmm. so that it was not a burden, and we did not require it. Most of the students took the trip, but we did not force them to go on the trip. And similarly with the Devil's Lake trip in the spring, they used to go in the first years by train. They took a Northwestern train up to Devil's Lake, and the students had to pay for that. In later years, the university covered expenses like that to some extent for bus trips to the Arboretum and things like that in the biology course. Mm-hmm. But we tried to give the students some first-hand experience with these scientific matters, and that was true not only of my course but of the other courses. The Chicago trip was abandoned, I think, late in the 50s when the astronomy department got its own planetarium. The planetarium in the astronomy department was, of course, a much simpler planetarium and could not show many of the things that the Chicago planetarium can show. But it was quite adequate for our needs. Mm-hmm. And after the astronomy department got its own planetarium, we would meet there as sections. The TA and 20 students would go to the planetarium. I would give them a lesson in how to operate the instrument and what to show them and so on. Mm-hmm. But this was a substitute for a lab, which proved to be fairly effective in getting the point across.
Were you teaching any courses in the chemistry department or in history of science while you were doing these ILS courses?
Yes, I was.
Because you've spoken of two courses you were giving in ILS.
Yes.
That is the PU course and then the advanced students.
Oh, I see, the honors course. Well, the honors course was really a section. The students took the same lectures as the rest of the students. And we, instead of a regular section, they went to an honors section. Yes, I was teaching freshman chemistry during these years. In fact, when Pooley went to Matthews and ask him whether I could be used to teach physical universe, Matthews, when I talked to Matthews about wishing to undertake this, Matthews asked me, well, what's going to happen to your freshman chemistry course? And I said, well, I'll continue to teach that. Which meant that I taught an overload compared to most chemistry professors. But I never felt terribly overburdened because I enjoyed the freshman chemistry. Oh. And so in order to teach the PU, I didn't react negatively toward continuing teaching the freshman chemistry. So I taught freshman chemistry from 1942, when I joined the faculty, until 1963, when I became chairman of ILS. Mm-hmm. I did have a break two or three times when I served as chairman when Pooley took leave of absence for a semester or a year. And I was excused from teaching freshman chemistry then.
And how did the chemistry department feel about that?
Well, surprisingly, Chairman Matthews was unenthusiastic about my taking on this job. But if I would continue to teach freshman chemistry, he would tolerate the deviance. Mm. I have a feeling that the course clicked very well in the first few years, and Matty actually was rather proud that I was involved in ILS. Mm. By the time that he retired, he was telling people what a nice job I was doing. Oh. So Matty was a remarkable chairman. He had a capacity for seeing what would benefit the university and the department. And if a person was doing that sort of thing, he would support him to the hilt. So my doing something outside the department, after he knew that I really wanted to do it, and when he heard that I seemed to be doing it well, well, he was very supportive, and he used to brag to his friends about teaching in ILS. Well, he himself taught a sociology course.
Really?
Yes. You see, Matthews, in the early 20s, was involved in the solving of a murder case in Wisconsin. The district attorney from a county upstate a ways brought him some materials from a workshop of the suspect. And Matthews did some comparison microscope studies on these artifacts and convinced the jury that this man was guilty. He had fabricated a homemade bomb and sent it to the person who was killed. And the only evidence that they had was a piece of metal from this man's workshop, which was the negative of the trigger on the bomb. And Matthews showed that the trigger and this piece of metal were identical from a metallurgical standpoint. So Matthews became very deeply involved in scientific methods of crime detection during his career. And I think it was probably around 1940 he began teaching a course in scientific methods of crime detection in the sociology department. So you see, he was a bit of a maverick. Mm. It was probably the best course he taught because he was deeply interested in scientific apparatus. He was not much of a chemist in comparison to others in the department, but he was positively talented with instruments. And whenever a new instrument became available for chemical research or analysis, Wisconsin would be one of the first universities to have such an instrument. Matthews and Malosh probably created the first course in instrumental analysis. I'm not certain that Wisconsin's course was the first, but in the late 20s, Malosh began teaching a course in instrumental methods of chemical analysis. Matthews was very much behind this. Mm-hmm. So he was a remarkable chairman. He had great devotion to the chemistry department and wanted it to be one of the best departments in the country. And he actually succeeded in bringing it up to that stature. He brought people like Adkins and Daniels into the department very early, and they began making a research reputation very early. Mm-hmm. Matthews was very supportive of anybody who was doing good research and saw to it that they had the instrumentation, the chemicals, the facilities to do research. As a chairman, he was a tough, hard-nosed chairman. The deans always trusted his budgets much more than they trusted the budgets of some chairman. I remember that if one wanted to do something new in the chemistry department, you did your homework on why you wanted to do it and what facilities would be needed and so on before you went to Matty. Because Matty would always raise some very searching questions. And if you had done your homework and could answer them, you would have an ardent supporter for your project. But if you hadn't done your homework, you would really be in the doghouse. Because Maddie would ask the right questions, what this was going to cost the university, what it was going to mean, in the direction of finding important information.
You know, we're on an extensive parenthesis now.
Yes, we are.
But it reminds me, I did interview Harvey Sorum, who
yes.
talked about the, I think it was the Rockefeller grant, was it, having to do with high school, updating high school teachers, I think.
Oh,
maybe it was.
That was National Science Foundation,
oh, all right.
wasn't it?
Yes, sorry.
In the 50s.
And apparently he had no support for the chemistry department for this.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say how this fits into your description of Matthews?
Well, Matthews was retired by that time.
Ah.
Yes, it was Daniels who was chairman at that time. And Daniels was a very first-class scientist. His administrative ability was vastly under that of Matthews. In fact, Matthews ran very tidy departmental meetings. We would meet on alternate Tuesdays at the University Club to discuss departmental business and policy. And Matthews always ran a tidy ship. When Daniels became chairman, he immediately started out by bringing all sorts of trivial matters to the department, and the faculty would become involved in fighting about very trivial things that Matthews always settled himself mm-hmm. and told nobody about them.
Mm-hmm.
So the department meetings became a shambles under Daniels, because you never got to important matters before people had to leave for classes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a great contrast of administrative capacity. Matthews loved chairmanship. Daniels looked upon it as something that needed to be done. And so one of the leading professors had to do it. But he was always looking ahead to his research
mm-hmm.
and not really giving the thought to departmental matters that Matthews used to give. You see, Matthews was chairman for 33 years, so many in the department disliked him because he was autocratic and could be very pointed in criticizing people, but he knew what he was doing, and deans knew that he knew that.
Yeah.
But it was a different chairmanship when Matthews retired. And we have had no long-time chairmanships ever since. But of course,
what is the date when that was introduced? Was it Dykstra who introduced that practice of
short chairmanships?
Yes.
I'm not certain that it originated with Dykstra. In fact, I think it just happened.
You do.
Without any conscious effort on the part of any administrator. You see, in the early days, the chairmanship was looked upon as an exceedingly prestigious job. And the chairmanship could generally be handled along with everything else that a professor did.
Mm.
Only he took a few hours a week off to answer letters and meet with the dean and things of that sort. But the chairmanship became more and more demanding as research expanded in the scientific departments. And as scholarship expanded in the humanistic and social studies departments. So that by the time Matthews retired, it was virtually a full-time job. And of course, If you look at the history of chairmanships in the university, I think you observe that the people who were chairman for long periods of time did not have much of a scholarly reputation.
Yes.
They supported scholarship, mm-hmm. but they themselves were not deeply involved.
Let's turn this. I wanted to ask you about the assemblies.
Yes. Professor Pooley had the idea when we started that it would be well to have one class hour per week set up as an assembly. And this was actually recorded as a course called ILS Zero. Huh. No credit, but mandatory. We met students on Saturday mornings at 11 o'clock. And Pooley, in the first weeks, discussed the purpose and philosophy of ILS, and then began inviting in professors from other departments who might contribute thoughts on their own discipline. In part, Pooley was thinking of this as a way that students could get acquainted with professors in other departments, and they might like to take elective courses in such departments. They might like to consider a major in this area. So it had one purpose of making the students aware of what was available in the university and giving them a consciousness of what psychology was like, or even what engineering was like.
Mm-hmm.
As I remember, a few times students planned their own programs. The course did not survive the first 2 years. Students began cutting it badly. And toward the end, there was just a handful of students and some of the faculty there. So it was dropped as a requirement after 2 years, as I remember. Perhaps in the first year it had some value, but students do not like to have an hour of their week tied up with something that doesn't produce a credit and a grade.
Mm.
So that it was not a terribly effective thing. Pooley used to come to our lectures from time to time and make announcements and sometimes discuss something for 10-15 minutes, which was a bit of a substitute for the assembly.
Mm-hmm.
But the assembly was one of the ideas which did not work out very well.
That must have disappointed him.
It did disappoint him, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't realize that it was so short-lived.
Yes. I might say that as important things came up, especially controversial things, ILS students sometimes met in evening meetings with interested professors to discuss this. And especially in the period of student dissent, we had a number of evening meetings with faculty and students there to discuss controversial issues about ILS or about the university.
Were these like the teach-ins, if you remember those?
No, there were some teach-ins run by ILS TAs. But these were not really teach-ins. These were really problem-solving meetings to bring understanding between faculty and students.
Mm.
I remember one particular case. I would suppose it was about 68 or 69. I was scheduled to go out to SUNY at Albany, where I was a consultant in connection with their history of science department and some of its problems. And I was scheduled to leave Madison in the early afternoon to spend a couple of days out there. Well, student dissent was at a very high level, and particularly high in ILS at that moment. And when I went home for lunch, I was discussing this with my wife, and she said, I think your place is here. You got to do something about this. And at that point, I agreed with her. So I got in touch with the ILS secretary and had her set up a meeting at the Episcopal House on University Avenue for that evening. All ILS TAs, students, and faculty invited. We had quite a knockdown, drag-out evening there, lasting from about 7 to 10:30 before we broke up. Some of the students wanted to pass a resolution that the university take action to condemn the U.S. policies in Vietnam. The faculty was successful in getting that watered down a great deal, but there were several resolutions that were passed at that meeting expressing a lack of sympathy with the Vietnam situation and other things dealing with ILS policies more precisely. I'd have to check back on my notes on that meeting.
Do you have those, do you?
I am quite sure I have some notes. I used to take notes and have them typed up and circulate to the faculty. So I think there are notes on that particular thing. I'll see if I can find them. But we had several evening meetings that I recall where there was a good deal of rather heady give and take between faculty and ILS students who thought that we weren't teaching things that were relevant, we weren't addressing the really important problems of the day, and so on.
Did this create a very large gap between the faculty and the students?
Well, it varied from individual to individual. There was a handful of, I suppose, about 20 students who were very activist and wanted to do things, kept turning up at my office, turning up at other professors' offices, and wanting to reform the program, reform the university.
So these were sophomores, presumably.
These were both freshmen and sophomores. Mm-hmm. Some of our freshmen were even more activist than sophomores. Mm-hmm. The TAs at that particular moment had a few members who were actually egging on the students. Mm-hmm. And they were getting together with them privately and giving them ideas that they should go to me or go to other people to criticize the program. And, of course, these same TAs ended up being involved very heavily in the TAA strike in 1970, wasn't it?
Yes.
Well, ILS suffered quite a bit during that strike because there was a nucleus of TAs who were very active in goals of the strikers.
I remember Taliaferro's name.
Yes.
I think he must have been one of the activists.
No. Taliaferro was never... Taliaferro was the chemistry demonstrator.
Yes, but he wasn't in the TA strike?
No.
Oh,
no.
That's interesting.
No, he was not in that. In the chemistry department, there were almost no chemistry TAs or RAs who supported the strike. There was one chap named Jennings Klein who was very much involved. But he was about the only one. There were a few others, but there was not more than a handful. And I do not recall that any of the chemistry TAs refused to meet classes in that period. Now, in the ILS, it was almost a shambles because the whole composition class TAs struck. One of the biology TAs struck, and I believe several of the social studies TAs struck. The science TAs were prone not to get involved to a significant degree. None of my own TAs were on the striker list. But the composition people and a few of the other humanities and social studies TAs were deeply involved. And we had to give up meeting students in composition during that period. Mrs. Schaff attempted to meet them herself. And it was very much a case of taking on the whole student body who were taking composition. Also, the ILS students were fairly supportive of the strike.
Yes, I imagine so.
And the TAs took advantage of them and persuaded the student leaders to picket lectures and section meetings, so that a lot of the students were not supportive of the strike, but they did not have the courage to cross picket lines where they had close friends picketing. So ILS had great difficulty during that period.
What was your own feeling about the strike and the issues?
I was never supportive of the strike and felt that the issues could have been resolved short of a strike. It's my feeling that TAs represent a rather unusual group. They are not full-time students, nor are they full-time faculty. They are really faculty assistants who are helping to get a teaching job done. And by doing that, they can support themselves to a significant degree in their graduate studies. They will not be permanent members of the faculty, and therefore I fail to see why they should have a substantial voice in determining academic policy. Certainly, there are many faculty members who will listen to a TA who has thoughts on how a subject should be taught. And I know that there are numerous faculty members who have incorporated ideas that TAs brought to them.
So it was the academic planning issue. What about the pay and the job security? How did you?
Well, I don't think that the pay issue was ever a major issue in the TAA strike.
Oh, and class size was one.
Class size was one. I was sympathetic toward their class size argument. I don't think that you can run an effective section with 25 or 30 students in the section. You can't generate good discussion which gets all students involved when you have 30 students in a section. It's my feeling that 20 students is about a maximum size. And I used to even like section sizes a little smaller than that. But when you get up to 24 and beyond, it is no longer as effective as it can be. I feel that same way about elementary education. I deplore school systems which force 30 and 40 students on a classroom teacher. But I think class size was an issue which I was sympathetic with their argument. I was totally unsympathetic with their wish to determine course content.
Yeah, that was the one that the faculty
really dug in. That's right. The faculty really dug in its heels on that, and rightly so, I think. Yes.
I would also be curious as to what your stand on the war was then during that period.
Well, my stand drifted from sadly supportive of the early action in Vietnam to very strongly opposed to the Vietnam action in the later years of the decade. I had some feeling in the beginning as Kennedy and Johnson were beginning to escalate this thing that it was the most unfortunate thing that the country could become involved in, because we were beginning to make progress on racial problems. And here comes this Vietnam War tearing the country to pieces at a time when it looked as if we could resolve a lot of our racial problems and get moving in that direction. So I think my early impression was that, well, probably we have to do what we're doing in Southeast Asia, but we ought to try to do it around the conference table rather than on the battlefield. And I became more firmly of the position that we were doing the wrong thing as that issue escalated.
So you were in sympathy with the students who were...
I was very much in sympathy with the anti-war movement, but I was not in sympathy with the way they were going about getting their point across. Mm-hmm. That is, I think basically I'm a gentle person and I like to see issues resolved by discussion rather than by violence. I confess that I felt supportive of the soldiers who were on campus during those several weeks that they were on campus.
The National Guard.
Right, mm-hmm. Yes. I couldn't feel that the students had a right to go around smashing windows and disrupting classes, things of that sort. Mm.
Yes. seemed to have been shared by a good number of people. Well, the final question I would have at the moment about ILS, that maybe others at some point, is they're thinking of discontinuing it now, and you were teaching in it right up to...
I taught in it right up to 1980.
So
I was chairman until 1970.
Feeling as to why there is this possibility of stopping the program.
Well, I think that the program is now firmly in control of things once more with the present faculty and director, though several years ago Dean Cronin was very firmly set to kill the program, and he was supported by his college advisory or his academic committee. I saw ILS going downhill during the period that I was chairman. I keep hoping that it wasn't because I was chairman, but maybe that was the cause. I see a number of causes. For one thing, we got badly bloodied, Mr. Pooley and I, when we attempted to create a second ILS program called Basic Studies about 1962 or 3. An ILS, an integrated type program, which would vary from the original ILS program by by a smaller number of required courses based to some extent on required elementary courses in the professional fields, students going into engineering, agriculture, medicine. We thought could benefit from a program which had many of the objectives of ILS, but was planned in a tighter way so as to permit students to get necessary prerequisites for their professional needs while at the same time getting a broad education. Mm-hmm. We got very badly bloodied on that fight, and the whole thing ended up being killed by the LNS College. And
bloodied by the faculty, is that
by the faculty? Mm-hmm. Yes. We had a fair amount of support from the deans of engineering and agriculture and medicine, but the LNS humanists and some of the scientists fought this bitterly. In part, Pooley and I didn't do our corridor work effectively beforehand. Mm-hmm. And the program seemed to be sprung out of thin air by the time the matter was brought before the LNS faculty. So that people from Spanish, physics, botany took leadership in killing the proposal. And they were successful in bringing about a killing of it. Second, I think ILS suffered from a curricular review which followed. And the Letters and Science College now required both mathematics and languages up to a heavier level than had been required originally. Mm-hmm. So that students, rather than taking a math course or a language course for their one first semester elective, were in a position where they were almost forced to take two. Mm-hmm. And so this led to an incompatibility which made the ILS program sufficiently tight that it became unattractive to many students. Mm-hmm. And third, I would attribute student discontent to the slippage of ILS.
Discontent?
Well, I mean the Vietnam War, the request for student control of academic matters, and so on. ILS peaked in its student population in 1964, and then it began slipping fairly rapidly. We had over 400 students that year, and the next year I think we were down about 100, and then we slipped more and more. Well, the students were fighting ILS. The students in the program were actually very critical of the program and were discouraging students from going into it. So this, along with the other things, the basic studies failure and the change in curricular requirements, led to a downfall of popularity. I think also that many students were concerned about getting on with their professional goals. We've got to get into a major. Mm-hmm. We've got to get into our professional area. We don't have time for ILS.
Yeah.
Now, the 50s was a beautiful period for general education, and it succeeded not only here but many other places. Mm-hmm. The 60s, you began to have a shift back toward emphasis on professional goals. So that I think that there was a host of things in the 60s that led to the slippage of ILS. There is a PhD thesis by Sam Kellams in education, which he interviewed me at length. He interviewed many of our students and some of our faculty, and prepared a PhD thesis dealing with ILS. So that is something that that I mention as having some relevance to the history of the program. I think that degree was around 1970, maybe a little earlier. But he caught the descent period. Mm-hmm. And I personally felt that it wasn't a terribly sympathetic job, but then maybe it shouldn't have been. There is another PhD thesis which grew out of a study of ILS by Lewis Stacker, which was very early. Stacker was a counselor in the ILS program in the early years, and he did his PhD thesis on I think he made a study of the kind of students who ended up in ILS, and he tried to look at what happened to them in their future college years. It was too early to have made a study of what happened to them after leaving college. Mm. And such a study really ought to be done.
I suppose you can start doing it now with this alumni.
Yes, yes. In fact, that's one thought, that some studies be made of what has happened to ILS students. I know from just anecdotal material that many of the ILS students have done very well in their professional careers, and that the program at least didn't hurt them. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that maybe part of their success is in some ways attributable to ILS. I know there are some who really feel that that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we have a bit of tape left. I have another question, which is how your wife supported you, or how she felt about your career and what you were doing over.
My wife has been a gem. She has been fully supportive of my entire career, and in fact she many times gave me sound advice, which I probably might have overlooked if I'd had to come up with it myself. In the very beginning, we were married while I was a research chemist in Chicago, and we left Chicago in February of 38.
I remember you went into that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. She supported me in giving up a stable job to go back to graduate school, because she thought that I would be happier doing academic work than bench chemistry all my life. She was active in graduate student and student wife affairs when I was in graduate school. In fact, are you aware of the let's see, what do they call it? The dames. There's a dame.
University dames
was a sort of a social organization of graduate student wives. The number of married grad students in that day was not large, but they had an organization which had been created some years ago by one of the faculty wives. Mm-hmm. And this group used to have interest groups, discussion groups, and so on. Mm-hmm. My wife was elected chairman of Dames in my last year as a graduate student, so mm-hmm. she was quite active in searching for better housing conditions. She got into a fight with Dykstra on graduate housing conditions. Dykstra took the position that grad students shouldn't be married, so there was no need to think of better housing conditions. Many of us lived in garrets or near garrets at that time. My wife did not have a job, as many grad student wives have today.
I meant later on in your career.
Yes. She typed my thesis. She typed my papers while I was a grad student. Olive was exceedingly supportive of my activities throughout my lifetime. And She put up with scarcity on many occasions because of the needs to get on with the academic career.
Did she mind your being very busy with your work?
She regretted that I didn't have more time with her and the children. Mm-hmm. But she was still supportive.